A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. A looming general election, a party on the verge of an historic landslide, a leader with an iron-like grip on message discipline, waging war on complacency. Sound familiar?
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Education, education, and education.
Tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
A politics of courage and honesty and trust.
Welcome to Lessons in a Landslide, an exclusive Red Box podcast series to mark 20 years since New Labour swept to power with 418 MPs. Recorded before Theresa May triggered her snap election, I've spoken to all of the key players in the 1997 campaign about life on the political front line and those infamous behind-the-scenes battles, including Peter Mandelson, Alistair Campbell and Angie Hunter. But we begin with the man at the centre of it all, Tony Blair. The New Labour frontman reflects on his paranoia that he might blow it all, his unsolvable conflicts with Gordon Brown, and his sadness at Blair right now being a dirty word in the party he led to three election victories.
For 18 years, 18 long years, my party has been in opposition. It could only say it could not do. Today, we are charged with the deep responsibility of government. Today, enough of talking. It is time now to do.
Began by asking him if he'd always wanted to be Prime Minister.
No, I never thought I would be Prime Minister. Actually, for a large part of my youth, I never had any interest in politics at all. I mean, if you told me when I was aged 18 or 19 that I was going to go into politics, never mind be Prime Minister, I would have not just dismissed the idea, but treated it with horror. So I got involved in politics a bit later. And even when I got into Parliament, I never had any thought of becoming Prime Minister because I was so much on the kind of moderate wing of the Labour Party that I thought...
Which wasn't the mood of the time.
Which wasn't the mood of the times, and it wasn't the traditional route to the leadership. The traditional route to the leadership was to be on the left and maybe then you moderated. Whereas I sort of was already in a sort of very much centrist position.
And so then when you became leader on July the 21st, 1994, at that point, how confident were you about them becoming Prime Minister?
Well, I thought that we had the right message for the country, which was a reformed Labour Party, then modernising the country. So I was very confident of the message, but when you've lost four elections in a row, including one that a lot of people thought we might have won in 1992, then you're naturally pretty hesitant. And I spent most of the next few years in an almost psychotic state of anti-complacency.
Yeah, this is the message which has come across from everyone who I've spoken to working on the campaign, and it all seemed to come from you. Don't be complacent. Always fearing that it could be a repeat of 92.
Yes, and that was also part... It was partly to keep everyone on their toes and make sure that they were working really hard for victory, and it was partly to reassure the public that we weren't, you know, taking it for granted, because I always thought if they got any sense of that, then not merely would it irritate them, but they might fear that a Labour Party in government would revert to the Labour Party that they had rejected very, very clearly in those previous four elections. And so, you know, there was never... This gets lost in the mists of time now, but there was never any doubt that we were going to be a different type of Labour Party. And in my view, that was absolutely central to our winning and central to our carrying on winning. Because I always had this idea that Labour could win an election as a kind of protest against the government in order to give the Tories a breather before they resumed their natural role of as the governing party. But if Labour wanted to change the country, it had to govern for more than one term, and it had to govern for more than one term with a significant majority.
So you described in an interview during the campaign how New Labour was very much your own creation. How important was the new in New Labour?
The new was vital. I mean, without the new, there wouldn't have been that size of majority for sure, and I don't think we would have then won successive majorities. Because, you know, people, the times had moved on, and people wanted a party that was committed to the traditional values of social justice, but accepted that, you know, you needed a thriving enterprise sector, you know, that we weren't going to turn the clock back on the Thatcher reforms that basically people more or less accepted. You know, you weren't going to put British Airways back into public ownership, for example. You know, you weren't going to scrap the legal framework for trade unions. You know, you weren't going to go back to sort of 80-90% rates of tax. So all of these things were part of what, frankly, is just was the new settlement of the times. What we wanted to do was take things in a different direction on investment in public services, on helping those who are most vulnerable, and things like, you know, the minimum wage and the social changes, civil partnerships and so on. So we had a whole set of changes we wanted to make, but they didn't depend on disturbing the previous settlement. On the contrary, they depended on building on it.
And so when you actually get into the actual campaign, do you enjoy campaigning? Do you enjoy the sort of hours on buses and helicopters and being out and about?
I enjoy being out and about, but if I'm really frank about it, the trouble when you're campaigning and you're the leader, you know, I used to enjoy campaigning a lot because I enjoy interacting with people. But when you're the leader and you're in that type of extraordinarily hyper atmosphere, then you're aware that you're on the at-risk register all the time. You know, it only requires one stray remark or, you know, someone does something, you know, and you're plunged into panic and chaos. So, no, I would say, you know, when you're leading your party in a campaign, I mean, some people just love even that part of it. I was always very conscious of the responsibility of it.
And it was exhausting, the process of campaigning and...
Yeah, the process of campaigning itself is very exhausting because you're making speeches the whole time and you're having to you know, keep incredibly focused. And then you've got big set piece interviews and so on, which can always go wrong. And, you know, for me, because of the Labour Party's long period in opposition and because, you know, people were still sceptical about whether it was possible for Labour really to come through, I was always aware of the enormity of the responsibility. And the realization that if I failed for any reason, then that was the Labour Party more or less finished.
On the subject of interviews, what for you was the more terrifying, doing sort of Dave or Dimbleby or Des O'Connor? Because it was quite a big deal when you did Des O'Connor.
Des O'Connor for sure is much more difficult. any interview when a politician is taken out of their natural habitat, which is answering questions about policy or political issues of the day, and they're translated into a context of you know, what are you like as a human being? You know, you're always conscious that either you may come across as, you know, just someone people don't like, or, you know, it's you're just out of your routine and you're out of where you're comfortable. So, no, the Des O'Connor interview, far more troubling than the sort of David Dimbleby type thing.
I wanted to ask you about sort of behind the scenes in the campaign, because it wasn't touched on much at the time, but now we know you had lots of big beasts around you, and sometimes they locked horns, whether it was over policy or just not being in the room for the meetings and all that sort of stuff. How much time or thought did you have to give to trying to manage these sort of egos in the team?
I mean, I was lucky because I had a brilliant team of people. You know, I mean, they really were and are a brilliant team of people. I mean, Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell, Peter Mandelson, you know, Angie Hunter, Sally Morgan, David Miliband, Philip Gould, of course, Margaret Madonna. You know, they were an extraordinary group of people. And then you had, you know, the big political figures like Gordon Brown, John Prescott and so on. But, you know, it's in the nature of really smart, capable people, especially people able to withstand pressure, that they're people of strong opinions and views. So, you know, managing that did take some effort. Although in that first campaign, to be fair, the joint venture of success was so compelling that mostly people check their egos out at the door, mostly, not always. But, and, you know, there's sometimes there was strong disagreement.
With your relationship with Gordon, and particularly Peter Mandelson talked about how he didn't even sort of sign off the economic policy, even as John Major was calling the election. Looking back now, do you wish you'd try to sort out that relationship before you went into government? Because actually those problems then continued afterwards.
I don't think it was sortable in the end, because it was born of what was a very difficult passage when John Smith died and then I became leader. But certainly at that stage, whatever difficulties there were more than compensated by the enormous contribution that Gordon made. And, you know, the fact that he was there as a huge figure and carrier of a message, and with the capability also of impressing people completely independently of my position, you know, that was enormously important. But I think the essence of the problem was never really changed.
Yeah. And so when you stood outside the Royal Festival Hall, New Dawn is Broken, you talked about how the result was moving and humbling. You spoke a lot about the responsibility of going into government. What was going through your mind as you sort of flew down from Sedgefield and you realised that not only had you won, you'd won by such a landslide?
I mean, it was a very odd feeling that night, because first of all, as the results came in, I actually at one point got worried that I was literally looking at the screen and thinking, I think it's time the Tories won a few more seats, because otherwise this is going to be so big it's going to be an embarrassment, and then people are going to think I've done something terrible to the constitution of the country. Because I think there was a moment early in the campaign, maybe just because of the way the seats came in, that you know, the Tories just had a handful and we were sort of mounting towards 100, and I was thinking, oh my God, this is too much. And the other thing was, I mean, I think I was one of the very few sober people around that night, and I was very sober and very, very conscious of the responsibility.
Were you frightened?
Yeah, I was. I mean, frightened is perhaps not the right word, but I was somewhat overawed, yeah.
Were you ready to be Prime Minister? Because one of the interesting things was the focus on not being complacent, but also focusing on winning the campaign, meant that you and lots of other people sort of hadn't been thinking about what the process of going to government had been. Do you think you were ready?
You're never ready when you come straight in off the back of 18 years of opposition. In that sense, you're never ready. We were ready in one way, which was very, very important. Although lots of policy was still to be decided, and that's natural. You know, an opposition party can't be expected to have all its policies worked out. And in fact, it's not even a good idea that it does. But we were ready in the sense that we were heavily oriented. In other words, we knew what type of government we wanted to be. We had certain clear principles established. So we didn't come in, you know, without a compass, but we did come in without having obviously yet done that journey and known what obstacles there are in the way. And, you know, the one thing you realise the moment you come in to government is that campaigning to be the government is completely different from governing as the government. And, you know, there is nothing really that prepares you quite for that if you haven't been in that position before.
New Labour obviously creates an incredibly broad coalition of public support, but some people have said actually it was quite shallow, and maybe you won over so many people, but it never became sort of baked in that New Labour, you know, the New Dawn broke in 97, but maybe the sun set in 10 years later when you left. It didn't become baked into the Labour Party.
Yeah, I don't agree with that, actually. I mean, the truth is David Miliband won the Labour leadership election in 2010. So actually within the Labour Party at that point, there was a majority for a modernising Labour Party. I think the coalition we created in the country was completely sustainable. And indeed, it was in a weird way, part of our coalition then went with David Cameron. You know, so but it was still very much a centre ground coalition. Okay, it was centre right then, not centre left. No, I've always believed that we did actually get to a coalition that was sustainable in a post-industrial revolution world where some of the old structures and old coalitions had broken down. And so, you know, the Labour Party that we put together was a Labour Party of people who were economically in favour of social justice, but as I say, in favour of enterprise, were socially liberal, were internationalist in outlook. And that coalition, I still think it exists in British politics today. It's not represented presently in British politics, but it's still there. I've got no doubt about it.
To what extent do you think that the enormous tidal wave of support and hope and optimism that you captured in 97 is partly why now you provoke a very different reaction? The sort of hero to zero, or you were really unable, it was always an impossible task for you to fulfil everything that people had invested in you in 97.
I think it's definitely true that the expectations were colossally out of line with anything that any government could possibly do. And actually, one of the really interesting things when you go back in time is you look at what we promised was extraordinarily modest. I mean, if you take that pledge card, the famous pledge card with the five pledges on it, we did them all. So in that sense, you could say, well, we fulfilled our promises. Part, yeah. But actually, when you look at them, they're incredibly modest. We ended up achieving far, far more than we ever promised, as a matter of fact. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, I still believe there's a lot of support for the basic political position. And this is to talk now about contemporary politics. But I think the polarization, particularly of the media, into a leftist and a rightist media that are very, you know, you can see this in America, you can see this elsewhere in Europe today, means that that center ground often appears to be discredited, when actually I still think there's enormous latent support for those positions amongst the public. But, you know, a lot of people prefer now to inhabit their own ecosystem of politics where they talk to people who just agree with each other. And I think, obviously, the last 10 years I've not been in the front line of politics. I mean, if I was, you know, we would be doing things very differently in order to try and change that situation, because I think the most dangerous thing you've got in Western politics at the moment is this polarization is now so intense that I think it becomes paralyzing for countries.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You talked a lot in your speech, I think at the Royal Festival Hall and outside, number 10, about trust and the people who put trust in you. Actually, the narrative around spin and New Labour spin and the erosion of trust, do you think that's fair? Do you think that because spin sort of went from being a good thing because you've got a grip on media management and, you know, you fed stories to the media, and then spin became a sort of stick to beat you with?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't think it's fair, because I think that in today's world, frankly, I don't know what government that came after us that didn't have a sophisticated communications machine. And nowadays, by the way, it's got to be even more sophisticated because of social media. Now, I think in the end, what we had was we had a governing project. I never felt in the whole 10 years I was prime minister that I was confronted with an idea that was better than ours. You know, I think when you came to the Labour government in the late 70s, and I think Jim Callaghan probably would have accepted this at the time, you felt there was a governing idea that was more powerful than the idea the Labour Party had at that time. I never felt that. And therefore, I think spin became a sort of reflex where it was really born in part of a frustration that people didn't quite know how to sort of topple us and defeat us. Yes, of course, we were a powerful media machine, but my God, we had to be. And if you'd grown up in the Labour Party as I did in the 1980s, when, you know, your leadership was getting, you know, literally eviscerated on a daily basis by the media, I mean, not to have adopted a proper media strategy would have been pretty foolish. I believe if we'd carried on with a modernising project, because this is the key to me, is that the world is changing today so fast, faster today than in 2007 and much faster than in 1997. And therefore, the spirit and the zeitgeist, if you like, that brought us to where we were in 1997, I think the irony is that even though New Labour is sort of rejected by the Labour Party today and in some sense also discredited by, of course, because it's in the right wing's interest to discredit it, actually the relevance of it as a concept, as an attitude, is greater today than it was even 20 years ago, because the world's changing even faster.
How do you feel now when New Labour and Blairites are dirty words in the party that you led?
Sad, because, you know, the Labour Party's only ever won when it's been a modernising project. It won in 1945 when, you know, I always say to people about Clem Attlee, you know, I ask them when he came into government, and they say 1945, and I say no, he'd been Deputy Prime Minister throughout the war years. You know, the fact is the Labour Party in 1945 was the outcome of a whole set of thoughts and ideas, and it was a modernising project in 1945. And 1964 is exactly the same. It was a modernising project under Harold Wilson. White hot heat of technology, social liberalism being added as a dimension to Labour thinking, and likewise in 1997. So I feel sad when people, you know, think that the answer is to go back, because it never is. And progressive parties only win when they're at the cutting edge of the future. If they become another form of small C conservatism, they usually lose.
And so how do you feel now, having led the Labour Party into 3 election wins? Do you worry that Labour might never win again?
There's no way Labour will win again unless it changes radically from where it is, in my view. I mean, there's no point kind of hiding that. And I think the evidence points to that. I mean, you know, when you're losing safe Labour seats to a second term Tory government, you know, if you're not worried, then, you know, I think you've got to ask yourself some pretty serious questions. So I think it's perfectly possible for Labour, and I hope it does recover itself, but it's going to have to recover itself radically. And this isn't a matter of the personality of the leader. We've got to understand where the world is, that we live in a world of accelerating change. You know, the next generation of technology is going to make even greater difference to the way people live and work and think. If the Labour Party's not able to comprehend that and engage from a public policy point of view with the modern world as it really is, then it's never going to appeal to sufficient numbers of people, because that old industrial base, you know, just isn't the same as it was 40, 50 years ago. I mean, I will say to people, when Sam Watson was the leader of the miners, the Durham miners back in the 50s, National Union of Mine Workers was a huge, even in just in County Durham, it was an enormous organisation. All of that's gone. You know, so you've got to replace that coalition with a new coalition today. If you don't do that, then you're out of sync with the way the world is changing. And what that means is that you can appeal to a group of people and they will give you very vociferous and vocal support,
but you've got no chance of reaching into the broad mass of people and forming a governing majority.
Is part of the problem that there aren't, after you and Gordon, there wasn't another generation of big beasts in the Labour Party, either brought on or developed? Part of the reason that Jeremy Corbyn won was because the alternatives were pretty uninspiring, and we look around now and there are people in the Labour Party now who are desperate for an alternative within the party, and no one seems to be leading that alternative.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a sceptic about, you know, our generation's great, but the next one's not so good. And I think there are lots of people there. And, you know, I think, no disrespect to Ed Miliband, but I think if David Miliband had won the leadership election in 2010, then the history of the party in the country might have been different.
Would you like to see him come back?
I always think there should be a place for David in British politics, because he's such a... you know, intelligent and decent man, but obviously that's for him. No, I think that there's plenty of great people out there. And by the way, when I meet the younger generation, the people in their late 20s and early 30s, sadly, some of whom are not really involved in the Labour Party, but they're really interested in politics. I mean, that's a fantastic generation. There's real talent out there. But it's going to require us now, I think, from where we are now, you've just got to rebuild an entirely new coalition. You've got to be reaching out to people in a completely different way. And you do have to show people that there is a policy agenda for the future. And this is, you know, what I'm working on now with this new institute. I mean, the centre ground's got to renew itself in terms of policy and ideas before it's able to renew itself in terms of political organisation.
Do you think there could come a point where the Corbyn project of running the Labour Party damages the Labour Party to such an extent that actually it's no longer the vehicle for that centre ground, and actually a new party is needed?
I don't, you know, I'm not advocating or in favour of new parties. I mean, I think the Labour Party can recover. You know, it's shown before in its history it's able to do that. I do, however, think the situation is serious and urgent.
You've got more in common with the Lib Dems now than the current Labour Party.
I mean, I wouldn't, you know, there's always times in my political life when people have said, well, you've got more in common with these people and these people rather than the Labour Party. But, you know, I've always found it curious. You know, I was leader of the Labour Party for 13 years and people always tell me I didn't understand it, and I don't understand it, but I do. I understand the Labour Party, and I study its history. But its history should show you that the one thing that is always fatal for a progressive party is self-indulgence, and is falling for the absolutely false dichotomy between principle and power. If we weren't able to introduce things like a minimum wage and, you know, civil partnerships, and just take something like the overseas aid program of the British government today that was founded by us, the International Development Department. I mean, there are millions of lives that have been touched by that around the world. I mean, these progressive things aren't done unless you're in power. I mean, obviously, on Brexit, for example, I probably do have more in common at the moment with the Lib Dems. And I think, by the way, I'm not tribal about politics, and I never have been. I think it's perfectly possible for people to cooperate across party lines. I think British politics would be more healthy if people did that. Same with American politics, by the way. Same with the politics on the continent of Europe today. You know, that's where I stand. So it's not that I feel a greater affinity with people outside my own political party, but, you know, I have to accept at the moment that the strain of Labour politics that I represent has obviously been marginalised within Labour. But I think the result of that marginalisation has not been to the Labour Party's advantage.
I just wanted to finish by asking you, what goes through your mind when you hear things can only get better? Did you become sick of the song, or does it take you right back to that time in 97?
Of course, it is a great ring of nostalgia to it. You know, I'm by nature forward-looking, not backward-looking, and it reminds me of what was a great time. And, you know, we did change the sort of tenor and tone of what went on in the country. And one of the tragedies, to my mind, of Brexit is that it really is, in the end, a profound throwback to the past. So, you know, when I hear things can only get better, you know, I mean, I'm more sort of amused and think of the more superficial memories. But when I think back in 1997, the advent of the Labour government, I mean, I think about it more in the context of today than I do of back then, because I think that attitude of sort of forward-looking open-mindedness is still what's necessary in British politics today.
And will you mark the 20th anniversary? You're going to get the old gang back together?
The old band?
Stick the music on.
Well, when you see all the bands that are touring nowadays from the 60s and 70s, I think, you know, well, there's always a place for us. But we all stay in touch, by the way, so we don't really need to raise a glass, as it were, on the 1st of May, 97. But in any event, sort of metaphorically, we will.
Tony Blair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Red Box's series Lessons in a Landslide. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes using iTunes on your Android device, and sign up to my morning Red Box email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.